Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening up Genesis 11, a scripture that tries to explain one of humanity's most fundamental traits, why we all speak different languages.
That's right. So we've already done deep dives on the historicity of Adam and Eve and the global flood. The Tower of Babel is really the next piece in that foundational puzzle. This story is the ancient world's attempt to figure out why, if everyone supposedly came from Noah's family, people suddenly started speaking thousands of different languages and spreading out.
And for a lot of modern faiths, the story of the Tower of Babel, you know, where God confounds a universal language, it's seen as more of an ideological parable about hubris, not a literal event.
Right.
But the challenge for you, our listener, is that certain modern scripture requires it to be taken literally.
Exactly. The Book of Mormon absolutely depends on this being a concrete historical event. So our mission today is really twofold. First, we'll unpack why secular and, frankly, most biblical scholarship sees this story as a myth. And second, we will trace exactly why the non-historicity of this one event creates this cascading kind of irreparable problem for the Book of Mormon's foundational claims.
So let's start where we always do, with the timeline. The whole idea of Babel rests on a world that's been reset after the flood. Where does biblical chronology put this event?
Well, if you calculate the genealogies from Noah forward, the traditional literal dating places, the Tower of Babel event, around, say, 2400 to 2200 BCE.
Okay, so about 100 to 200 years after the global flood.
Precisely. And that date is absolutely critical.
So we're meant to imagine a world with just 8 survivors, and a century later, a single universal language is being spoken everywhere until God just switches it all up.
And this is where history and linguistics just present a massive unified objection. I mean, if the Tower of Babel was the moment that one language became many, the archaeological record flatly contradicts that.
Okay, so give us the hard dates. What languages do we have evidence for before 2200 BCE?
Oh, a lot. We have a huge amount of documented diversity. Sumerian, for example, which is one of the oldest languages we know of, was already being written down for administration and literature as early as 3500 BCE.
3500, wow.
Yeah, and then you've got Egyptian hieroglyphs documented back to 3300 BCE. We have Akkadian records from 2800 BCE.
So let's just pause on that. You're saying we have sophisticated, distinct written languages being used by massive civilizations more than 1,000 years before the date when the one universal language was supposedly confused.
It makes the Babel story linguistically impossible. Languages just don't pop into existence fully formed. They need centuries, millennia even, to diverge and become so different that people can't understand each other.
Right.
The idea that language was uniform for 100 years and then instantly diversified in 2200 BCE, it just ignores everything we know about how language actually evolves.
It's kind of humbling to think the Egyptians were writing detailed records while this foundational biblical event hadn't even supposedly happened yet. But what's really interesting is that the Bible itself seems to undermine the story.
It absolutely does. If you just flip back one chapter to Genesis 10, it's often called the Table of Nations, it describes the descendants of Noah's sons.
Ham, Shem, and Japheth.
Right. And the text clearly says that these groups were already divided after their tongues, in their countries, and in their nations.
So Genesis 10 describes a world with multiple languages already existing before Genesis 11 describes the event that supposedly created them.
It's a classic internal contradiction. It strongly suggests that Genesis 10 and 11 were written by different people or came from different traditions and were stitched together later by an editor.
One tradition that recognized reality and another that was trying to explain it away with the story.
Basically, yeah.
The linguistic evidence is pretty overwhelming, but there's another issue that often gets overlooked, and that's just the math. Sticking to that literal biblical timeline, if you start with 8 people after the flood, what's the population by the time of the tower?
Well, this is what's called the population bottleneck problem. If you start with the 8 survivors on the ark, and you project forward about a century, maybe a little more, you factor in the 70 male descendants mentioned in Genesis 10, plus their families. The absolute most generous global population you could have is maybe 150 to 200 people.
So we're talking about the size of a very small village.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you contrast that tiny number with what archaeologists estimate for the world population by 2000 BCE. And those estimates, they range, but they're somewhere between 27 million and 72 million people.
That's a huge discrepancy.
There's simply no evidence of the kind of demographic catastrophe that a global flood would require, which, you know, makes the starting conditions for Babel impossible on its own.
And what about the practical side of actually building the tower? I mean, the story describes this massive project, right? A tower to reach the heavens.
It's just not feasible. The idea that 150 people could gather the materials, organize the labor, and engineer a structure of that magnitude, it's just completely impossible. The scale doesn't match the demographics.
So physically, mathematically, linguistically, the event just doesn't hold up. If it's not a real event, then it must have come from somewhere else. Where do scholars think this story actually came from?
For that, we have to look to Babylon. The scholarly consensus is pretty much universal on this. The Tower of Babel story is a polemic. It's a kind of satirical attack aimed at the Babylonians.
The regional superpower at the time.
Exactly. And we even have earlier myths that touch on these same ideas. There's a Sumerian myth and Merkar and the Lord of Arada from around 2100 BCE. And it has a prayer in it that talks about a time when all people spoke one language.
So the general idea was already out there.
It was in the cultural air, for sure. But the more direct influence probably comes from an Assyrian myth from the 8th century BCE.
What does that one say?
It's strikingly similar. It talks about how the gods were upset by the wickedness of men building some massive structure. So the gods destroy the work, they confound their speech, and they scatter the people. It's almost a template for Genesis 11.
And was there a specific building, a physical tower, that the biblical writers were reacting to?
Almost certainly. That would be the great ziggurat in Babylon, Etemenanki, which was dedicated to their god, Marduk. This wasn't just a temple, it was a massive stepped pyramid meant to connect heaven and earth.
And the timing of when Genesis was written is key here, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
Etemenanki was famously rebuilt in the 6th century BCE, which is the exact period of the Babylonian captivity when the Hebrews were exiled in Babylon. So scholars believe the Genesis texts were being compiled right then and there. The story of Babel was likely written by these exiled Hebrews as a way to mock their captors. You know, look at this huge tower you built in your pride. Our God sees it and brought you to confusion.
Okay, this is where the scholarly analysis slams right into the specific scriptural claims that you, the listener, might hold. Because for Latter-day Saints, the Book of Mormon, specifically the Book of Ether, takes this Babylonian polemic and turns it into non-negotiable physical history.
It totally removes the option of seeing Babel as a metaphor. The Book of Ether says explicitly that the Jaredites came from the great tower at the time the Lord confounded the language of the people. This event is the literal starting point for their entire civilization.
Now, I know some people try to find a way around this. They'll focus on the small details, the bark of the tree, and say, well, the Book of Ether doesn't use the name Babel, so maybe it was a different tower.
Right, that's a common apologetic argument, but it falls apart as soon as you actually read the text. The Book of Mormon itself ties this event directly to the biblical story. Ether 2, verse 1, clearly says the Jaredites' journey started in the valley of Nimrod.
Nimrod.
The figure from Genesis 10, the mighty hunter, who is directly associated with the people who built the Tower of Babel in the land of Shinar. By placing the Jaredites' origin in Nimrod's territory, the Book of Mormon makes the identity of the tower completely explicit. There's no wiggle room.
And what about the official position within the faith? Is there any room for a metaphorical interpretation?
Not really, no. The official and overwhelmingly top position is that the story must be literal. I mean, you have BYU professors writing in official church magazines like the Ensign, confirming that Latter-day Saints must accept the Genesis account literally with the Book of Mormon as a second witness.
So a metaphorical Tower of Babel isn't really an option if you're following that guidance.
It isn't, because the Book of Mormon needs it to be the literal starting point for an entire people.
And this is where it gets really fascinating, because now we can trace the chain of consequences. If the Tower of Babel is a myth, what are the historical dominoes that fall for Joseph Smith's claims, specifically for how he said he translated the Book of Mormon?
This is the critical chain of dependency. So if the Tower of Babel is a myth, the first casualty is the historicity of the Jaredites themselves. Their entire story begins at that event.
Okay, that follows. No tower, no Jaredites. So what physical, tangible things from the Book of Mormon depend on the Jaredites?
Well, the Jaredite record was on 24 plates. But even more important, the text describes how the brother of Jared needed light for their ships, so he asked the Lord to touch 16 small, clear stones to make them glow.
The 16 stones, they were the light source for their journey across the ocean.
Yes, and those 16 stones, having been touched by God, were preserved. The text explains that these artifacts were passed down through generations of Nephites and became known as the Nephite interpreters.
Wait, so these weren't just some generic magical rocks. They are specific physical artifacts created at the time of the mythical Tower of Babel by the brother of Jared.
Precisely. They are material artifacts that originate with the Jaredite civilization, which in turn originates at the Tower of Babel. These interpreters, sometimes called the spectacles, or later retroactively named the Urim and Thummim, were the very tools Joseph Smith claimed he received with the gold plates.
They were essential to his translation method.
They were the mechanism of translation.
So this is the core implication. If the Tower of Babel is non-historical, if that foundational event is a myth, then the Nephite interpreters Joseph Smith claimed to have simply were never created.
It immediately invalidates the entire material and historical foundation of the Book of Mormon's translation process. The whole thing is built on an artifact that comes directly from a mythical event. If you put non-historical material in at the foundation, you can't get historical material out at the end.
And you have to put this in the context of the 1830s. Joseph Smith was operating in a world where the Bible was seen as a literal history book.
Absolutely. His attempt to write a sequel, one built on a literal Adam and Eve, a literal global flood, and a literal Tower of Babel, inadvertently created a whole series of testable historical claims. And those claims just, they fail when you test them against external evidence like linguistics, archaeology, and population science.
So to wrap up this deep dive for you, we've established that the diversity of ancient languages, the impossible population math after the flood, and the story's clear roots in 6th-century Babylonian polemics all point to one conclusion. The Tower of Babel is a myth.
And the problem for this modern scripture is that it's cemented that myth as a physical historical event. The key takeaway is that line of dependency. It runs from a literal tower to the literal Jaredites to the creation of the literal Nephite interpreters and finally to Joseph Smith's translation. That entire chain has to be literal for the claims to work.
A lot of people, when they're faced with this, tend to focus on the bark of the tree. You know, they argue over the etymology of one word or try to find a second, different tower somewhere.
Right, but the evidence really points to the entire forest. When you step back and look at the whole picture, Adam and Eve, the flood, and Babel, these foundational pillars that hold up the physical translation claims are all contradicted by multiple fields of science and history.
So the final thought for you to explore is about intellectual consistency. What external body of evidence from science, from history, would you allow to challenge a belief that is so foundational? Especially when that belief rests on an unbroken chain of artifacts that seem to come from events that the evidence suggests never actually happened. If the outside world is telling you the foundation isn't historical, where do you place the weight of your trust?